We'll call the meeting to order to start it. We don't have a quorum yet, so we can't take official action, but Representative Hansen has a bill that's been referred to us, House File 66, and we'll get started on that till we get a quorum, and now we have a quorum
and a gavel.
So I'll officially call this meeting to order. The legislative assistant will take the roll, and Representative Hansen, you're a member of the committee, so do you want to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 66 and move it to the General Register of the recommendation to pass.
Yes. Go ahead. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I was hoping to amend that to have this go to agriculture, since this does affect the rural areas and farming.
Representative Quam and Representative Hansen, I've been told that the Agriculture Committee does not want to see it. The chair from Ag told me they don't want to see it, and they don't need to see it. So the motion is currently to move it to, but and you made a motion to amend the motion. I realize that.
Correct, and I request a roll call on the motion to amend to send it to Ag.
Point of information.
Representative Ward.
Why would agriculture deny this? Why don't they want to see it? I'd like to understand a little bit more before I vote.
I do not know. I was just told that the chair said he does not need to see it. She does not need to see it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would speak against Representative Quam's amendment. And the reason is that this statute, and if you look at the title and the divisions, 103E are drainage provisions. They are not, and they deal with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. The jurisdiction for these statutes rests and has rested in the environmental area, not in the agricultural area. And I could maybe just confirm with Mr. Kane, who works for the Board of Water and Soil Resources, that those provisions are in the environmental policy area, and they've gone through Chair Dill's committee already.
Okay, there's a motion on the any more questions? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just, you know, and Representative Hansen, I understand if you look at the section, it relates to Bowser. Representative Hansen, as you and I and probably everybody on the committee knows, Bowser as an agency works directly with farmers in probably close to 100% of the things that they do. And the reality is, from a practical standpoint, farmers have a huge stake in what happens in terms of drainage legislation, drainage law. It would be improper and irresponsible for us, I think, as a legislature, to not have this run before the committee that deals with agricultural interests, and have representative the ability for farmers to look at laws that affect them through the lens of their culture and their understanding, their businesses and their interests, rather than being run through a series of committees that, and I understand Representative Dill is on the Environment Policy Committee, but we had this discussion on the floor, and I know that it's going to probably be discussed more this session, as we've engineered our committee structure to be controlled by Minneapolis folks rather than the interests of agriculture. This is one that ties directly to agriculture. It's incumbent upon us to have agriculture see the bill.
Okay. So I'll take a, we're ready to take a vote here with a roll call. Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for the record, I also serve on the Agriculture Policy Committee. The chair has not indicated to me that the bill is to come to them. I do not fear, if this bill were to go to them, that there would be any problem with the bill. This was, as the chair of the Environment Policy Committee, I thought it was very important to have a bipartisan bill come out of my committee the first meeting that we had. And we had the very first meeting that we had this good bipartisan bill where Representative Torkelson, Representative Hansen worked together to get this before us. It's on a fast track. If the members are feel that it should go to ag policy, that's your feeling. I don't necessarily think it is because I know that that chair has reviewed the bill.
Mr. Chair, I understand that Bowser also...
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that Bowser also approved in favor of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Any further questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No matter who approves it, part of what we're here to do is have the discussion and have the public and interested parties be able to hear the debate and testify and have their say. And because of the treatments here do directly affect farmers, our major and rural areas, having it in the agriculture committee, the policy committee, allows for the venue where these interested parties would go to be able to have their say, have their hearing, and have their day at the legislature. And so it's not opposing the bill. I just think it's appropriate to allow for that venue and that discussion in the agriculture committee, because too often we neglect to give due diligence to the fact that this state depends so greatly upon its agriculture, and I think we need to give its due respect. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Just in closing, and I was intrigued when Representative Dill was referred to as a Minneapolis member of Representative Drazkowski. I didn't know if he moved or not, but in Representative Dill's committee, we did ask the agricultural interests for their a show of support, and I think some of them are here, or they're going to be here today, but this bill was negotiated at Farm Bureau headquarters with a broad coalition of people. This is a consensus bill, and in the audience and in Representative Dill's committee, they indicated their support. So they've had their opportunity to testify and indicated their support in Representative Dill's committee where the jurisdiction lies with Bowser statute. So again, I would oppose the amendment.
Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Hansen, if you listened closely to what I said, I did recognize that Representative Dill was not a Minneapolis legislator. And in reality, I was pointing to the propensity for the new majority to send the bulk of especially finance provisions and probably many policy provisions too through the Environment, Natural Resources, and Agriculture Finance Committee, which is controlled by Minneapolis environmental advocates, if you will. That's the issue that I'm looking at, Representative Hansen. Here we have a bill that affects agriculture. It's strictly a policy bill, and it has the ability to go before agriculture. Why don't we at least allow those bills that do have the ability to go before agriculture to go before agriculture, given our current structure?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as Representative Hansen said, it is true that that we gave ample opportunity for Mr. Schoenfeld, Mr. Peterson, Mr. Clavin, many other ag representatives to come to the table and testify on this bill. This is not the Environment Finance Committee. I understand the animosity that exists over the appointment of the chair to ag finance. It's been well demonstrated on the floor, but the fact is that this is a good bipartisan bill, and Representative Torkelson, who is an author of the bill, has not even come to me and said it should go to ag policy. So I sense that what we're doing here right now is we're just setting the stage for disagreement in future times when we're dealing with policy issues that are well embraced by the user groups that were developed over time with the exact user groups that are going to have the ability to review it in another committee. Again, if it's the wish of this committee to send it to Ag Policy, I'm just fine with it. Or I'm fine with making another motion, just tabling the bill and forgetting the whole thing. How's that? I mean, I'm not going to play games here. Everyone knows me. I don't play games. And so we either pass the bill or we put it over to Ag. One of the two, or I'm going to make a motion to table the bill and we're not going to do anything. That's it.
Any further discussion? If not, I'll take the Paige will take the roll.
Nelson?
No.
Freiberg?
No.
Dill?
No.
Dorholt?
No.
Drazkowski?
Yes.
Hansen?
No.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh?
Yes.
Quam?
Yes.
Ward?
No.
Winkler?
No.
The motion fails 7-4. So we're back on the original motion to pass and place on the general register. And Representative Hansen, would you describe your bill? And I know we just have the two minor pieces here that are pertain to us. And so if you leave your testimony and your questions to that, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have with me Mr. Kane from the Borderlands for Resources to talk about Section 1, Section 2, Section 3, the definition changes that are the government operations purview.
Go ahead, proceed, and please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Al Kane. I serve as the Chief Engineer for the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I also serve as the facilitator for the Stakeholder Drainage Work Group. From which this recommendations for this bill came as consensus recommendations for updates of Minnesota drainage law. Section 1, 2, and 3 were related to other provisions in the bill. Section 1 about the definition of board and Section 3 regarding the definition of secretary relate to the roles of the different drainage authorities who implement Chapter 103 drainage law. And within the definition of board, it had previously been focused just on counties as drainage authorities. Since watershed district law has been in place and over the years, that was also defined as a role, the drainage authority role for watershed districts. And in fact, in Chapter 103B, Section 211, there's also a provision for metropolitan watershed management organizations to also use the 103D watershed district provisions for administration of Chapter 103E drainage systems. So the drainage work group is recommending that we clarify the definition of board to include the joint county boards, which are for drainage systems that go across county lines. There's multiple counties involved, and therefore they have joint boards to administer those systems. Watershed districts, which under Chapter 103D have authority to serve as drainage authorities, and then also for watershed management organizations in the metropolitan area, which have authority to use Chapter 103D as a drainage authority under Chapter 103B. Again, that was Section 211. So that's the reason that we're updating, recommending updating the definition of board within drainage law. Again, it's a clarification. It's not any new authorities within that definition. If we move to Section 3, that is a definition of the secretary of a watershed district, which also can serve as the a lot of the roles that an auditor does for a county as a drainage authority. And that hadn't been defined within drainage law clearly. So this is a clarification to add a definition for secretary to make it clear of the roles and responsibilities of the watershed district secretary for implementation of drainage law. Section 2, which is an update of the definition of director, is because the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources recently had consolidated departments, and now what was the Division of Waters is currently the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. So that was an update while we were at updating definitions to include that update of the definition for the director. And I will stand for any questions.
So there any, thank you, Mr. Kane. Are there any questions of Mr. Kane or of the representative? Mr. Druskowski, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kane and maybe Representative Hansen as well. And one of the things I know we've talked about Environment Committee and other places is these watershed districts and the almost overlap, if you will, between the watershed districts and soil and water conservation districts. And this seems to be giving more involvement or recognition maybe of those watershed districts. I'd be interested just in your comments about what we're looking at in the future in terms of resolution of that overlap and how this affects or does not affect that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Druskowski, that's a good question. The way the statute has been is that the drainage authority, the authority for dealing with drainage systems, has been with counties and with watershed districts. To my knowledge, and Mr. Kane can correct me, I don't believe there is a soil and water conservation district that has the drainage authority for dealing with the systems. And the watershed districts have, as you know, have the taxing authority and are appointed by the counties, whereas the soil and water conservation districts are elected but do not have the taxing authority. So the ability here has been with the watershed districts, the appointed bodies with the taxing authority, where a county board may select them to be the drainage authority rather than having the county do it. In Section 1, we have a wrinkle in the metro area where you have watershed management organizations which serve also with the same type of authority as watershed districts. And I'm not sure if there is a county that has designated one as a drainage authority in the metro area to date. Primarily it is in the western tier or western edge of the state where counties have selected watershed districts to have that responsibility and the authority to be dealing with all of the provisions in the drainage law.
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chairman, members, I would only add the clarification that this does not, the recommendations do not change any of the existing authorities for watershed districts, counties for serving as drainage authorities. Again, it does clarify that there is a provision that the Metropolitan Watershed Management Organizations can. They're not required to utilize Chapter 103D Watershed District Law to administer Chapter 103E Drainage Systems. It is an optional, if you will, authority within 103B. And therefore, this recommendation to update the definition of board doesn't change any of the relationship between a watershed district and a soil and water conservation district, which does not serve as a drainage authority under Chapter 103E.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I may be a little bit slow in getting this, but typically property records are stored at counties, and there's a really good reason that all the records are related to filings and so forth are consolidated in one single place. It's for ease of determining property records, any encumbrances, all those things that are necessary to transfer property. So is this bill doing something different to actually create another register or another office where encumbrances on property or other kinds of filings that may affect the transferability or other rights that go along with the transfer rights of property are going to be stored so that you would actually end up searching in two places rather than one?
Representative Hansen. Or Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the recommendations do not change where those records are kept for property encumbrances, for example. Watershed districts have overlap with counties, of course, and therefore they must work with multiple counties for the roles that the auditor plays in records storage, in notification of landowners who are part of a drainage system. Again, that all still works through the counties too. So there's a partnership, if you will, between watershed districts and counties for those roles, and there's not a duplication of those records. The only place where the recommendations before you have a potential two sets of data or records is for the drainage system records. One of the recommendations within this bill is to provide for transfer of records from a county to a watershed district. Again, it's not that it hasn't been occurring, it's just that it hasn't been real clear as to exactly how to do that. And where a drainage system is transferred, let's say in part, from a county to a watershed district, one of the challenges right now is that both the county and the watershed district need records for that drainage system. The provisions within this bill allow for an authenticated copy when there is a situation where both the county and the watershed district have a need for those drainage system records. And the drainage system records are, in fact, just that. It's for the drainage system records, the proceedings, for the definition of dimensions of a ditch or a tile. Those are the kind of records that both a county and a watershed district may have need for, and this bill helps clarify when, how to do transfer, and how to create authenticated copies where they're needed.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. So, Mr. King, just kind of high-level assurance, we're not setting up a system in which watershed districts are going to be keeping a set of records that are separate from what are available at the county auditor's official records. And the reason I have a little concern is I see that right-of-way is listed, line 2.28. So, yes, the technical definition of what a drainage system is, but right-of-ways obviously are have an impact on real property. So I just want I'm good with your assurance, but your assurance is that there are not going to be records that are separate at the watershed district or different in any way from the exact same records that are available through the county auditor.
Mr. Kane.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe that's a correct interpretation because, again, this bill does not change any of the existing way that records are kept other than clarifying how to transfer and enabling a copy, authenticated copy, of drainage system records, which, again, are not all of the records to which you're referring that a county as a general purpose government keeps on land.
Okay. And
Representative Winkler.
Chair, Representative Hansen, maybe we can do a follow-up at some point. The language in 2.8 says the auditor or secretary shall keep all charts, profiles, plats, plans, specifications, records of the proceedings. The or in there could lead one to believe that the watershed district could develop separate sets of records from the auditor. And it may be that I'm just looking at one little couple pieces of language, and if I had a full explanation of the whole bill, that concern would disappear. But it's just something to think about. I'm not worried about holding this up at this point, but it's just a question I'd like to make sure we're very confident about the answer.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, we'd be happy to work with you as this goes on. Just of note, and something that we will probably be seeing in the future, is some of these records are 100 years old. They are old copies of drawings and that. And what we have tried to do and we're hoping to do in the future is digitize these records to make them more usable for folks, that we can have them functional wherever they are rather than rolling out the old map that's mm-hmm. probably pretty brittle. So you'll be seeing something like that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Winkler's question, and maybe this will help provide a little bit of clarity for you, Representative Winkler, the way I see your the maintenance of these records is you have two different repositories. You have the county recorder's office, which is statutorily charged with encumbering properties with or recording encumbrances for liens, easements, dedications, restrictive covenants, and the like. What I see these gentlemen talking about is maybe more the schematics of where those are on maps and those types of things that might not otherwise be a part of the public record, and its location of maintenance and housing.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I know. I mean, I understand what they're talking about, but still old specifications, old technical drawings can impact property because they can be evidence of encumbrances that might not otherwise be there. I'm sure that this isn't going to be a problem. I just want to make doubly sure in the end that we're not assuming that it's going to all kind of work out because we intend two different things. And, you know, we don't want to start creating a system where you have to hire more lawyers to go search the county auditors and recorders and then go to the Watershed District Board because, you know, obviously having more legal business wouldn't be good for the state. So I'm sure it will work out, but we just need further I would like some more assurance that we're not going to create a dual system.
Representative O'Driscoll.
My final comment, Mr. Chair. We also have things that are done and maintained at the local level, the city or the township level, in the way of ordinances and things that never make their way into the public record as well. I see these matters that the Representative Hansen and the testifier are talking about, just again for some clarification.
Any further questions or comments? Otherwise, we'll go to a vote. Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 66 be passed and moved to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you.
And representatives and members, I made a minor screw-up yesterday, or mess-up, when we referred House File 55 to property taxes. It should have gone to taxes. So we need to reconsider that and then do the proper motion. So I move that we reconsider House File 55. It's still in our possession. If you want copies, we have copies here, but it's the same bill we passed yesterday. All in favor of reconsideration? Please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is approved or passes. Now I'd like to renew make the motion that House File 55 be passed and sent to taxes. Re-referred to taxes. Any questions? Otherwise, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes and it's going to taxes. Thank you, gentlemen. And ladies, now we have an overview from the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
And if you can state your name for the record and then proceed with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jeff Hamill. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Executive Officer of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. It's a pleasure to be here before the committee again, and I say again because I've been before this committee on numerous occasions. However, I think the membership of the committee is relatively new and not as familiar as past committees with the history and the background of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. So today it's good to be back, and I'm looking forward to giving you some background and an overview of the MAC and how we maintain and operate the airports in the Seven County Metropolitan Area. Just by way of brief background, we report to two committees in the House and two committees in the Senate on an annual basis, and then any place else that we're requested to speak to members, both the government ops and local government committees in the House and the Senate, and also the transportation committees relative to air transportation issues as well. By way of background, we have a rich aviation history in the state of Minnesota and throughout the metropolitan community as well. But going back to the 1930s and 1940s, Minneapolis and St. Paul both operated municipal airports. Those airports competed for air service. And as a result, we had aircraft that would depart the Minneapolis Municipal Airport, approximately where the current airport's located, fly to the St. Paul Municipal Airport, pick up passengers, then go on to Rochester and down through Wisconsin into Chicago. In the early 1940s, Governor Harold Stassen at the time decided that it didn't make a great deal of sense to have multiple airport facilities in the metropolitan community with air service and cargo services, and as a result, in cooperation with the state legislature in 1943, created the Metropolitan Airports Commission. We were the first commission created by the legislature, and our specific purpose and role was to basically operate the aviation system in the seven-county metropolitan area. In fact, by definition, our area of authority is a 35-mile radius from downtown City Hall, St. Paul, downtown City Hall, Minneapolis. We're overlapping circles that basically take in all seven counties in the metro area, and then bits and pieces and corners of, I think, seven additional counties within that 35-mile radius. We basically operate a system of seven airports in the metropolitan community. In addition to Minneapolis St. Paul International Airport, which is most well known, we also operate six relievers. On the east side of St. Paul, there's the Lake Elmo Airport. To the north is the Anoka County Airport, the Crystal Airport in Northwest Metropolitan Area, the Flying Cloud Airport out in Eden Prairie, and the Air Lake Airport down in Lakeville. The whole concept of this system of airports, which is unique in the United States, there are relatively few airport systems around the country operated by one authority, is to try to provide operating facilities based on the needs of the aircraft operator. For example, if you're a private operator and you fly a single-engine prop or twin-engine propeller airplane, you probably don't have a need for 10, 11, 12,000-foot runways. And as a result, we've located these reliever airports to relieve the demand and congestion upon MSP International to preserve its capacity for the large aircraft that need long runways and terminal facilities. So it's an effort to try to desaturate MSP, spread the traffic out throughout our reliever system, giving operators of aircraft, whether corporate operators or private operators, a chance to choose an airport closer to their ultimate destination. And that system seems to have worked extremely well over the last 60-plus years. The MAC is, by the way, I think that slide behind me, I can't see it, I'm not looking at this end, but I think it talks about some 1,500 aircraft are hangared on our six reliever airports in the system. That's about half of all the aircraft that are registered in the state of Minnesota, and somewhere in the vicinity of about 385,000-386,000 takeoffs and landings occur annually. That number has been declining in more recent years. It's probably down below 360,000 today. But the overall, a reflection of the economy, by the way. But overall, about half of all the operations that take off and land in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area take place on those smaller airports. Airports typically across the country are structured with local governments. Many airports are operated by city governments, by county governments, in some cases by state government. Minneapolis Sample's a bit different. We are more of a hybrid operation where we are basically a commission created by the legislature and given the authority to provide aviation services and facilities, provide those services to our community overall. An example of a county-operated airport would be, for example, the Miami-Dade County Airport, which is run by a county board. The City of Chicago runs the airport system in Chicago, which includes O'Hare and Midway Airport. And that's also true throughout the state of Minnesota. Most of the airports in the state are airports that are operated by the local city government or county boards. Our board consists of 15 members. Those 15 members are comprised of the following. 12 commissioners are appointed by the governor. 8 of those commissioners come from the Seven County metropolitan area within that 35-mile radius I discussed momentarily or previously, and 4 come from greater Minnesota. In addition to that, the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul both have one appointment each. And the chairman himself or herself is appointed directly by the governor. The chairman serves at the pleasure of the governor.
I'm just turning up the volume.
Oh, sure. The chairman of the Metropolitan Airports Commission at the present time, Dan Bolvin, is appointed by the governor and serves at the pleasure of the governor. The two mayors serve during their terms, and when their terms expire or if a new mayor is elected in Minneapolis or St. Paul, they have the discretion to appoint a new replacement commissioner. Total composition of the board then equals 15 total commissioners. So the board is a body that has the ability to authorize us to do all the expenditures, authorize the construction expansion of our airport system, and represent the various communities that are affected by the airport. Looking at the funding of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, we are unique in that, unlike most government agencies throughout the state of Minnesota, we receive no general revenues from the state of Minnesota through the general fund. We basically are an organization that is structured on generating our own revenue through user fees to support our overall operation. The Airports Commission has a long history of expansion and development and investment in the community to meet the needs, and these funds are basically generated through very, very specific revenue sources. For example, We charge the airline companies that serve Minneapolis, St. Paul a fee to land on our runway system, approximately $2.50 per 1,000 pounds of landed weight. So a 100,000-pound airplane would pay about $250 to land on our runway surfaces. And, of course, the heavier the airplane, the larger the airplane, the more they pay. The smaller the airplane, the less they pay. We also generate revenue on our airport system via the rates and charges that we charge the airline industry. For example, when the aircraft lands on the runway, taxis to the gate, we charge them on an annual basis the fee that it costs us to park the airplane on the concrete at the gate. We charge them for the use of the gate. We charge them a general fee for the use of concourses to connect through our terminal facility. We charge them for their ticket counters, the carousels for baggage claim, any office space that they may occupy. The Airports Commission also owns most of the airports and structures on the airport, and as a result, as we lease or rent those facilities out, airlines and or other operators on the airfield pay us a fee in the form of rental for those facilities they occupy. And this model permits us to generate the revenue over the long term to pay for the investment that we've made on those facilities. We also have the ability to generate revenue through this user concept by charging the traveling public. So as a result, when you come to the airport and park your vehicle, we charge you to park in our garages. We charge you for the various services that are provided, such as food and beverage and retail sales. We take a percentage of the revenue from both food and beverage facilities and retail services in the terminal building. And through those various venues, we generate the revenues necessary to operate and maintain the system. We also have the ability to borrow money and issue bonds. And we've done that extensively over the last 15 or 20 years to make the improvements that you see on the airport today. MAC enjoys a very solid and very strong financial position. We have one of the highest bond ratings in the country of airports overall, with a AA- bond rating on our general airport obligation, our general revenue bonds. We also have taxing authority authorized by you that we can exercise. However, we've not exercised that since the early to mid-1960s and have built a financial model that would not encourage us or even suggest that we would need to exercise that taxing authority. When I say user pay concept, let me just talk a bit about revenue generated. We need about $270 million a year in operating revenues to support the activities of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport and our reliever airport system. To give you an example of sources of revenue, our parking concession at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport generates about $70 million a year in revenue. What that does is basically pay the long-term debt obligation on the construction of those facilities and other facilities and so forth on the airport. That concept works very well throughout our facilities, and in fact, auto rental companies, taxi and limousine services, other ground facilities that we rent and so forth on lease, plus utilities, are all part of the revenue-generating mechanism that works to pay and meet our obligation. The end result is that we believe we're unique in government in that we do not depend upon approvals or authorizations or allocation from the state legislature to support the airport system coming out of the general fund. It is a self-sustaining model that works extremely well. I think that's just a summary review of what I just went through. Overall economic impact of the airport, we're just now finishing our most recent economic impact study, but somewhere in the area of about $10 billion of economic revenue is generated by the operation of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. That is the business generated by bringing business travelers, leisure travelers, vacation travelers to the Minneapolis-St. Paul market, and the businesses conducted by those businesses. We generate about $600 million a year in general sales tax and tax revenues for the state of Minnesota. And as a result, you can see that the model is a very valuable one. In fact, overall, we would tell you that between the Twin Cities and probably the west coast of Seattle and as far south as probably Kansas City, at St. Louis, Kansas City, and over to Chicago, the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport's 3,100 acres of property is probably the largest revenue-generating piece of real estate in the north upper Midwest of the United States. Looking at capital funding, we spend approximately $100 million a year making certain improvements and just maintaining the facilities at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. About $50 million, that's just annual operating expense to maintain runways, taxiways, aprons, building maintenance and improvements, parking garages and ramps and so forth, just by virtue of our climate and just the use of our facilities. The other $50 million a year typically is spent on capital improvement programs and projects to improve the airport to meet future and projected demand and growth. You can see on the photograph behind me, the airport consists of five runways. We have two runways that go northwest to southeast that are parallel runways. They are predominantly used by the airport for most of our operations. We have a north-south runway on the west side, or on the right side of the photograph, that appears to run more north than south, with the top of the photograph being north. And we have a cross runway that diagonally cuts across from the northeast to the southwest. That's our longest runway, and that's basically a crosswind runway we use when the wind conditions are such that we can't use the other primary runways. To maintain that facility, as I said, is anywhere from $50 to $100 million a year. When we do have an expansion program, that expansion program, in fact, incorporates significantly more money, and there have been years where we spent more than $300 or $400 million in a year on construction. I'll talk about that in just a few moments. Funding sources also include the collection of $4.50 from every departing passenger. It's called the passenger facility fee, excuse me. And this is an important part of revenues for us because, unlike other revenues that we generate from tax structures through ticket taxes and so forth, the $4.50 passenger facility fee stays in the Minneapolis-St. Paul market. It is collected by the airline companies as part of your ticket sale. That money is then passed through the airline companies back to the Metropolitan Airports Commission for local investment in our local airport system. There's also an approximate 10% ticket tax that you pay to the federal government. Those 10% dollars go into the Aviation Trust Fund in Washington, D.C., and we as an airport compete with all other airports in the country to get our portion or our share of that money back into our local community. We probably contribute today somewhere in the area of about $40 to $45 million a year into the Aviation Trust Fund based on ticket sales, and in fact get back somewhere between $15 and $20 million for improvements and so forth on authorized and approved projects granted by the Federal Aviation Administration. As far as environmental stewardship goes, let me just briefly say that the Metropolitan Airports Commission has definitely has the most aggressive noise mitigation program of any airport in the country. And I'll go farther and simply say that I don't know of an airport in the world that has spent the money and committed its time and energies to environmental responsibility as we have when it comes to noise mitigation around the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. I won't belabor the issue, but to simply say to you that we have, over the course of the last 20 years, spent nearly $500 million in noise mitigation to include the insulation of schools inside the DNL 65 noise contour. That's a contour defined by the federal government as being a noise-impacted zone. Those 17 schools have new heating and air conditioning systems, new windows, new noise and sound abatement insulation packages that were included in those buildings. We've insulated more than 14,700 homes in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. It's the largest home insulation program in the country. Those homes receive exterior windows, exterior doors, internal insulation, and depending on the needs of the facility, the home could receive also air conditioning and heating systems to support the noise goals of the airport. It is an extensive program. It is a program that is ongoing, and we are near the end of insulating all the appropriate homes and facilities that are noise sensitive within the DNL 60 noise contour. And I make that point without confusing you to simply say that at the federal government level, the federal government's defined the DNL, the day noise sound level, at 65 as being an impact zone. So if you live in an area that's 65 decibels or noisier, you are in a noise impact area. At the Metropolitan Airports Commission, we've gone a bit farther. We say that if you live in the 60 DNL noise contour, you're experiencing noise impact, and as a result, we have a special exemption from the FAA to spend aviation dollars to insulate out to the 60 DNL. These are logarithmic. They're not linear calculations, and as a result, when you go from 70 to 65, you are from 70 decibels to 65, and then from 65 to 60, you are doubling the geographic area of impact. So when we extend it from 65 out to 60, we significantly increase the contours and made more of our citizens available and eligible for insulation. Our rationale for doing that, quite frankly, is that our airport is an urban airport nested closely within the residential communities around the airport. Bloomington, Richfield, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Mendota Heights, and Eagan, and a little bit farther to the south, Burnsville and South Eagan, are all impacted by our operation. The convenience and the location of the airport is appreciated by travelers, but at the same time causes consternation and concern for citizens. As a result, we felt it was our obligation to do whatever we can do to respond to those concerns of environmental impact. A little bit about Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. We are the 12th busiest airport in North America, with more than 430,000 takeoffs and landings in 2011. We're the 15th busiest airport in America based on passenger traffic and passenger activity. Approximately 33.1 million passengers traveled through our facilities in 2011. By the way, that's a split of activity. About 46 or 47% of our traffic are people who are simply connecting through our facility, typically passengers on Delta Airlines who are simply connecting from a departure point to their ultimate destination through the Twin Cities. The other 52 or 53% are what we call OND, origination destination passengers. These are people who are originating or terminating their travel because they want to be in or from the Minneapolis-St. Paul marketplace. In other words, they're doing business or departing the Twin Cities to do business elsewhere. And as a result, our local demand for air services. We are one of the most efficiently operated airports in the United States. Our overall cost of operation is extremely competitive. One of the measures that we use is what we call cost per plane passenger. What that means is how much does it cost an airline company to transfer or transport one passenger through our facilities compared to other facilities around the country. At the national level, airports such as San Francisco charge up to $28 per passenger. The national average is somewhere around $9.50 to $10 per passenger. In Minneapolis-St. Paul, our cost per plane passenger transfer passenger is about $6.50. Some of the lower cost airports are in the $2 and $3 range. Typically, you'll find those airports that low because there's significant county or city subsidies provided to the airport to reduce its operating cost. And as a result, they have more revenues coming from local government than they do from the airport's operation. Bottom line is that Minneapolis-St. Paul is a significant hub within the national transportation network, and of the top 29 airports in the nation, which are all listed as large hubs, that is those airports that carry more than 1% of the total traffic in a year, we're about in the middle of that group at about number 14, number 15. We have a unique situation in that we enjoy incredible air service, and I use that term with intent. We have more service to nonstop destinations than any other community in the United States except for Denver, Colorado. On a per capita basis, there are more frequencies to more nonstop destinations than any place except Denver, Colorado. That includes New York, Los Angeles, Miami, Dallas-Fort Worth, Chicago. While they have more daily flights on a per capita basis, Minneapolis-St. Paul travelers who wish to go nonstop, they go to more than 142 destinations nonstop out of the Twin Cities. And on a per capita basis, that is a substantial amenity. And in fact, contributes, I think, to part of the reason why we're able, in a small part, in our part of this equation, to support business needs, to be able to get connected to the business communities and markets, not only in the United States, but around the world. We have nonstop air service internationally to 22 destination points. Those are primarily Canada and the Caribbean. We also have nonstop service on a daily basis to Tokyo, and that gives you one-stop service into China and the entire Asian community. It gives you we have service to Europe through London, Amsterdam, and Paris, France. So we have good air service, and we're continuing to search for more and improved air service as well. One of the criticisms of the Metropolitan Airports Commission is that we have permitted the facility to become a dominant fortress hub of Delta Airlines. People tell us that 80% of all of our operations are provided by one carrier, and as a result, our ticket prices are high, and that we should be aggressively pursuing competitive opportunities to try to reduce those airfares. And in fact, on this slide behind me, I believe you're looking at the recruiting efforts that we have stepped forward on over the last several years. Since 2008, we've seen Alaska Air come into the marketplace. Southwest Airlines entered the market in 2009. That was an 18-year effort to try to convince Southwest to enter this marketplace. We basically told them on five occasions they missed a golden opportunity. And finally, in 2009, they took our word for it, started service, and they've had significant increases in support from our community and provide service to more cities than they had anticipated when they first started service in 2009. We've also seen Great Lakes Aviation enter the marketplace, primarily filling a niche. You may recall in the newspaper a couple of years ago, Delta reducing service to small communities in greater Minnesota and the Dakotas. To respond to that need, we talked with Great Lakes Aviation, which is a smaller airline company operating turboprop. These are jet-driven, propeller-driven aircraft, but jet-powered, to provide service to smaller communities. To Delta, it did not make sense to provide a 50-passenger jet to a community to pick up 5 or 7 or 10 people. but it does make sense for Great Lakes Aviation with a 19-passenger turboprop aircraft to pick up 5 or 7 or 9 people in the community. So what we've done is worked with the airlines to try to find a right-sizing formula where the aircraft that's appropriately sized and fitted to meet the needs of the community can provide air service and do so in an economic model. So while many communities don't like losing jet service or have not lost it, really it is that the service that's there today is appropriate for connecting from their community into Minneapolis-St. Paul as a hub and then onto their final destinations. And, of course, Spirit Airlines entered the market in 2012, providing a unique low-discounted service. Spirit's the airline that charges for just about everything that you want. The actual fare is low, but whatever you want on the flight, from beverages to a pillow to checking your bags and bringing a bag on board, you're charged a fee for those services. But it does give travelers in Minneapolis-St. Paul a choice as to what level of service and amenity they would like to have. We are by far the largest economic generator. I've already talked about that, but let's talk about jobs specifically. There are about 17,000 people who work on the airport every day. Those 17,000 people work for the Airports Commission, the Federal Aviation Administration, the Transportation Security Administration, the airlines that serve the Minneapolis-St. Paul market, and, of course, all the folks who work in the food and beverage retail sales concessions in our facility. Those people are a large number of employment. It's down from our highest level of about 22 or 23,000 employees, but 17,000 is a large complement. Of the 17,000 who work at the airport, only about 575 or 508 are actually Metropolitan Airports Commission employees. So we're a very small contingent of the workforce at the airport. Overall, if you look at the economic impact, about 70,000 jobs are directly related to the airport. These are companies and businesses that have people who come to the airport, conduct business as a result of the airport, people provide services directly to the airport or to the businesses on the airport. So we are a significant job creator and a very significant job sustainer. Let me move on and talk a little bit about the improvements that we made at the airport and kind of draw this to a close for questions and answers. Between 1995 and 2010, we had a program moving forward called the Dual Airport Planning Process. This was basically planning for the future, going back to the early 1990s. In fact, it was the legislature, that passed the Airport Planning Act in 1989, directing us to take a look at future aviation needs of the metropolitan community in the state of Minnesota. That resulted in a $3.2 billion program in construction between 1995 and 2010 that resulted in a new fourth runway being built on the airport. The Humphrey Terminal building was built. We expanded the Lindbergh Terminal building. We built 4 new parking ramps on the airport, built new auto rental facilities, built the various trams that get you to and around the airport, and also paid a portion, the on-airport portion of the light rail transit system, which goes underneath the airport, connecting Minneapolis to the Mall of America underneath the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. We actually have 2 stations on the airport, one underneath the Lindbergh Terminal building and the other, which is underground about 85 or 90 feet below grade, and also one that connects on ground level at the Humphrey Terminal building facility. We are now beyond that program, have completed that $3.2 billion program, and are moving toward the 2020-2030 future look. We completed our long-term comprehensive plan for 2030, and we are looking at spending probably another $2 to $2.4 billion over the next 15 or 20 years to improve our airport to make certain that we are continually competitive, providing adequate and important aviation services for our community to sustain our community's ability to be connected with the global marketplace. We do not need any additional runways, ramps, or taxiways on the airport. The entire airport runway system, has been rebuilt and, quite frankly, is probably not in need of significant investment for the next 35 to 50 years. There will always be routine maintenance on the runway system. It's an important part of our operation, obviously. But as far as building new runways or expanding additional runways on the airport, that is simply not necessary. We do have to build, however, terminal facilities to meet the growth in demand. I told you earlier today that we had about 33 or so million passengers a year. Our forecast showed that by 2030 that number will grow from 33 million to over 50 million passengers. Our current gate structure to accommodate the parking of aircraft and to accommodate the flow of passengers through our facilities simply is not adequate to meet that demand. So over the next 15 years, you will see and learn more about our efforts to try to expand and build additional gate and parking facilities on the airport. Today we have about 125 gates. We'll grow the airport both in Humphrey and Lindbergh terminals to about 150 gates. That's not a significant increase in the number of gates, but what it will do is require moving some of the gates to accommodate higher capacity airplanes with wider wingspans. We currently have about 22,000 parking spaces on the airport. That will ultimately grow to about 40,000 parking spaces over the next 10 to 15 years as we expand our complex. As I said a few moments ago, we're going to spend about another $2.4 billion to make sure that this airport can meet the future growth and demand of our community. That, I believe, Mr. Chairman and committee members, gives you kind of a snapshot overview of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. And what I'd like to do is reserve any time we have left to respond to concerns you may have or questions you may have regarding the operation of MSP and or our relief airport system.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. And I've got a couple questions here that come up all the time about the airports, and you've touched on some of these, but the first one I have here talks about how do you coordinate with air service needs with all the outstate airports, and then you touched a little bit on that, but maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit more.
Let me answer by starting to say that Metropolitan Airports Commission, created by you, has this 35-mile radius kind of a jurisdictional area, and so we are responsible for all airport aircraft operations in the metropolitan area. In Greater Minnesota, we play a role as well, and that is that along with the State Department of Aeronautics, under MnDOT's guidance, we also support and maintain and work with outstate airports. I, in the last year and a half, have been in Duluth, St. Cloud, Mankato, Thief River Falls, Hibbing, Brainerd, Grand Rapids. We basically go wherever we're asked to go to talk about aviation and air services throughout the state of Minnesota. The state, through the State Department of Aeronautics, provides assistance to local communities who operate their own airports. They also provide some assistance financially to the Metropolitan Airports Commission, but what's different about the MAC is that we actually own and operate the airports serving the needs of the metropolitan community as a whole. Throughout the state of Minnesota, those airports are not owned by the State Department of Transportation Aeronautics Division. They are owned by local communities who receive some consulting services and financial aid through MnDOT's Division of Aeronautics. So we basically travel. I talk to communities. I've been most recently helping the city of St. Cloud work on developing new air service for its community and giving them advice on what kind of service would be best serving the needs of that community, which means not flying from St. Cloud to Minneapolis-St. Paul, but securing air service direct from St. Cloud to Chicago, giving folks in that part of the state direct air service to a larger connecting network to travel domestically or worldwide. So we have an aggressive program, and we respond when we're called. We do not necessarily initiate dialogue because of our jurisdictional limitations. But each year I work with the Minnesota Council of Airports. I speak regularly to their annual conference, talk about updates within the Minneapolis-St. Paul system, and offer system and Q&A and dialogue in any way we possibly can for those airport operations.
The second question I have here that is, how do you fund the reliever airports? You talk about the, I know Crystal's in my district, we've got the St. Paul Airport, Flying Cloud, and probably Anoka Airport. I'm probably missing some that.
Yeah. Well, the reliever airport system, as I say, was designed to provide and relieve pressure upon MSP. But unlike MSP, we don't have scheduled airline operations and people who pay fees on a regular basis to use those facilities. So what we do is we become, I think, basically landlords. We are landlords that provide people a fee on a square footage basis to lease the land from us upon which they would build their hangars to support their private or business aviation needs. So, for example, if you owned an aircraft and had a small business and you had a single-engine or twin-engine prop airplane and wanted to build a hangar in one of our airports, we would work a lease with you, charge you a per square footage annual rate for that lease, and you would then have a place to hangar your aircraft and basically operate your aviation side of your business or your personal recreational interest. We also charge a percentage of sales to our operators on the airfield to provide fueling services, air taxi, air charter, and maintenance for aircraft operations in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. We also draw revenues from MSP through Signature Flight Support to fund the general aviation operations at MSP, providing some support to the general aviation activities on our reliever system as well to spread some of the wealth, I might say, of MSP's operation to that reliever airport system. Our goal is to try to keep our costs low, encouraging people to use those airports and to make aviation a financially viable enterprise for our community.
And the last question I guess I have for you here is, what do you do to you talked a little bit about that, bringing more airlines in here so they're not just so dependent on Delta. But what other things do you do to promote competition and get more airlines in here?
Mr. Chairman, members, I have a member of my staff, along with other folks who work on a part-time basis on air service development issues. That individual travels to domestic international markets and participates in international trade activities, where he meets on a regular basis with potential carriers that may look at Minneapolis-St. Paul as being a potential market. Domestically, the only airline company of any real size that does not serve the Twin Cities is JetBlue. Brian Peters on our staff meets with JetBlue at least twice a year and maintains regular frequent communication with them. You have to remember that the decision to serve a community is a boardroom decision of an airline company. All we can do is tell our story, talk about the amenities and the positive impacts or aspects of serving the Minneapolis-St. Paul market. We've been assured by JetBlue that, in fact, they will serve the Twin Cities. It's a matter of when they decide to pull that trigger. Are they going to come in 2013, 2015, 2017? We simply don't know. But by meeting with them on a regular basis and keeping them abreast of air service needs in the Twin Cities and in the upper Midwest, we meet on a regular basis with domestic carriers. We've also had a discussion with the Virgin Atlantic, Virgin America, other carriers, but I think JetBlue is the one that really is noticeably not here today. On an international scene, we've talked with British Air, with Lufthansa, Aeromexico, Mexicana. We talk with carriers on an international basis as well, and where we think there are markets that are needed. Important point here is that we try to meet with the business community and business leadership. In fact, I had a presentation last week with the Minnesota Business Partnership. One of the questions I asked that group was, where do you see your future needs for air transportation, primarily in the global marketplace? The world is getting smaller. Nonstop air service to Asia, to Europe, Central and South America, and Africa, I think will grow in intensity and demand for our community. So we asked business leaders and travel organizations, what do you see are your needs to be in the 3 to 5 year horizon, and where should we be focusing our attention? So we have a fairly aggressive recruiting program, staffed by one person primarily, but several of us work together on that venture to improve our domestic service as well as improve our international service. And quite frankly, that's a competitive situation that quite frankly keeps Delta Airlines and higher fares in check. So we are pretty aggressive about recruiting these carriers.
Thank you, Mr. Freiberg. And Representative Freiberg, and we've got another presentation, so if we can keep short the questions,
sure,
and keep short the answers would be great.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand there was an issue where some flights were going to be redirected over the western suburbs. Some of the local governments raised some issues with that. There may have been a compromise. I'm just wondering what the status of that is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Freiberg, yes, you're talking about the Federal Aviation's national program called NextGen. It's the next generation of technologies that are being initiated by the Federal Aviation Administration. The FAA comes to local airports and basically solicits and asks for our support as they implement new strategies to improve the overall efficiency, safety, and operation of the national air transportation system. To be honest, it gets a long discussion. It's complicated, but to simply distill it down to a one-minute presentation, the FAA now has the ability to very precisely position aircraft on arrival and departure flight tracks. Historically, over the course of time, when an aircraft would depart the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, the air traffic control tower would clear that aircraft for takeoff, and they would say, cleared for takeoff, climb to and maintain 7,000 feet, turn west heading 270. And the aircraft kind of comes off the runway based on its weight, its length, its size, and so forth, and begins a turn and a climb, and begins its way en route. But the pilot's basically heading generally west, and in the cockpit has a navigation aid that he can fly to be in kind of his entry into the national airspace highway system. It's a generally, it depends on the aircraft and the technology on board, that flight track can be a mile or a mile and a half wide. With new technologies now, they can make it very precise. And within about a 4-mile radius of the airport, aircraft can hone in on a very specific path that flies over specific neighborhoods with great precision, not this broad scattering. And what's happened over the implementation of this new next-gen strategy in Minneapolis-St. Paul is that most of the communities around the airport have understood this, have been studying this issue since as early as 2007, and have endorsed it because they believe it's a fair, equitable distribution of aircraft operations throughout our community. However, Southwest Minneapolis and Edina felt as if they had not been properly informed and briefed, felt that they had not been included in these discussions. There's an argument in that regard that's not worth getting into today. But in any event, challenge the Airports Commission to be more disclosing on some of these flight tracks and the impacts. We, in fact, advised the FAA that the timeline that they had for the Minneapolis sample implementation of NextGen was too aggressive, that we needed more time in the communities. They did not recognize that as a need, and as a result, the Commission responded to communities' needs at our Commission meeting a month and a half ago and basically endorsed the NextGen technologies for those communities that supported it to the east and the south of the airport, and did not support implementation strategies to the west of the airport. FAA is currently reviewing its procedures. They are studying the impacts, and we expect to receive a report back from them in the next 30 to 60 days, taking a look at how we'll approach implementation strategies in the future. I will simply tell you that we believe there wasn't adequate time to brief all the communities impacted, primarily Edina, which is outside the noise impact zone. And we will put together a program in cooperation with the FAA that will, in fact, fully disclose all of the impacts, all the information they need to make a good judge decision. Those communities that have studied this in great detail understand the airport is where it is, and basically people are going to be exposed to noise, and we'll have to do an appropriate community outreach program to satisfy needs and answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Representative Quam. And again, if we can make the answer a little bit shorter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, with your redirection, I was curious, when you have international flights and customs, how many international airports are there in the state? And then what are the next two largest airports and passengers? And then one quick thing. You said you haven't used your taxing authority. If you did, what area would you be taxing from, and would you have to come to the legislature in order to get that approved, the levy?
We are authorized one-third mill on the real property in the seven-county metropolitan area. So that gives you a sense of that. And I don't know what those dollars are today, but that's basically the formula. And you've already given us that authorization. We can proceed. However, honestly, we would make you well aware of that if we were to initiate that. And in fact, by law, have to notify the Metropolitan Council and the legislature of our intent to institute those taxes. As far as international air service goes, Minneapolis-St. Paul is the only airport that has regularly scheduled international air service to the 22 destination points. However, Rochester and Duluth do have air service that connects through Minneapolis-St. Paul or to other airports that do have one-stop international service to other communities. And we have actually large aircraft scheduled operations from Duluth, Rochester, and Minneapolis-St. Paul.
Representative Dill.
I just want to thank you, Mr. Hamill. Going to the standard instrument departures and the fact that we're very much more specific now with the new next-gen navigation, hasn't that helped with the noise? Because along with the increased first and second stage climb gradient of these new generation aircraft is so much steeper after liftoff than the old airplanes that I'm familiar with, Boeing 707s and 727s. I mean, this should make a dramatic impact. So what I'm asking is has that shrunk the area where do you still have the same area that you had in the 60s or 70s or even 80s when we used the older generation aircraft and those rings around the airport, those decibel rings, have they stayed the same or have they shrunk because of the increase in the climb gradient?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in fact, we calculate those contours, those noise impact contours, and then insulate out to those contours. And in fact, over the last 5 to 7 years, even though the airport historically has grown over time with more passengers and more operations, the aircraft themselves have become quieter, and the performance capability of those aircraft have become significantly improved. So as a result, aircraft take off more aggressively, climb at a higher rate, or gain higher altitude earlier, and do so with less noise and less fuel consumption. The way I kind of simplify it is to say to make a lot of noise takes a lot of gas. Today's jet aircraft, the new production aircraft coming off the line today, consume about one-half the fuel of the older generation airplanes going back to the old DC-9s and the 727s. As far as the contour goes, that contour has retracted over the course of the years from our original contour. We expect that contour will move from time to time, and as the airport grows toward that 50 million passengers a year in 2030, we'll see our operations grow from about 436,000 today to somewhere around 525,000 operations. At that time, the contour will be back about the same size, but aircraft will be significantly noticeably higher. So you've got a pretty good understanding of how the system works. And NextGen does, in fact, improve noise mitigation in the community as a whole.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will try to make this as quick as possible, but it does affect myself and Representative Dorholt in the way of questioning, because one of the airports that's been considered as a an additional outside of the seven-county metro ring reliever airport is the St. Cloud Regional Airport, and that lies just outside of my district and just inside of Representative Dorholt's district. Question that I have is that was not necessarily going to be looked at as a passenger reliever, but as a potential commercial reliever in the way of freight and those types of things, and there was some discussion about connecting Highways 10 and 94 with a bypass or connector between there to be able to facilitate that. We didn't hear anything about freight today. In 90 seconds or less, if you could give me an update on and others as to where we're at.
Chairman, how about 30 seconds?
Mr. Hamill.
To both of you. St. Cloud, I think, has a lot of opportunity. They've made some significant improvements. It's a significant investment for the community around the St. Cloud Regional Airport. But as far as a major freight hub, just remember is that when the aircraft lands, then somehow you have to get that freight into the metropolitan community as a whole. And the reality is that from a practical operating standpoint, it's unlikely that we'll see significant air freight, air cargo activities in St. Cloud and then being trucked on highways into the Twin Cities. It's much more economically viable for them to fly into the Twin Cities, get the distribution in the Twin Cities, and then move outward into the greater Minnesota. So my answer would be that I think cargo is not a bright economic opportunity for St. Cloud.
Representative Winkler.
Thank
you. This will be our last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hamill, I do think that our community and our business community are well served by MSP being a hub airport for Delta. Costs, you know, is a separate issue, I think. But the question I have is with the departure of Northwest Airlines, is there what's the likelihood of MSP declining as a hub in the total airport system? Is the fact that the headquarters is gone going to make it sort of become less important over time, or do you think that we're locked in enough that we're going to be a hub for years to come and have that amenity?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, your timing of your question couldn't be better. Yesterday, Bill Lynch, who's the Executive Vice President for Minnesota Operations for Delta Airlines, had about a 30-minute presentation to our board during our board meeting. And Mr. Lynch indicated that Minneapolis-St. Paul now ranks as the second largest airport in the Delta airline system internationally, that the hub is strong, that is priced competitively, that we have a very strong business demand for air service in the Minneapolis-St. Paul market. We have more Fortune 500s, by the way, per capita than any other metropolitan area in the metropolitan community in the country except for Denver. And as a result of the fact that we tend to want to travel, we have a very stable unemployment compared, very good employment percentages compared to the nation, and a continuous demand for access to world markets for both business and personal and leisure travel. The Delta sees Minneapolis-St. Paul as a very important part of their network system. And we were assured yesterday once again, and we are privately in meetings with Delta in Atlanta, that in fact Minneapolis is important and will stay very important to Delta.
Thank you for your thing. And I don't understand why, with the nice weather we've had the last few days, why anyone would want to travel away from here.
I'm with you. I don't understand it either, Mr. Chairman.
Anyway,
thank you very much for your time. I'm sorry for the long presentation and the long answers, but at any time you would like to come to the airport, or if you'd like to arrange a tour and go through facilities at a more mild climate time of the year, the invitation is open. We've got I think an interesting place for you to kind of walk through and take a look with us on our facilities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and thank you for your presentation.
Sure, I'd love a field trip out there.
We can look into that and do it maybe towards the end of session or maybe after session. The next we have the Metropolitan Council, an overview, and your agenda says Pat Bourne, but I guess he was called into a meeting with the governor, so we have replacement. So switch it, or yeah, I can't even think of the word now, but anyway, Wes Koistra?
Wes Koistra, yes.
Koistra, okay. Sure. Deputy Regional Administrator, so, and we can get the technology working. It looks like he's got...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Skowski.
Just a question, Mr. Chair. There's only about 12 or 13 minutes left. Is the plan, this is kind of a significant item, is the plan to maybe extend to another hearing with this presentation, or just to
kind of
run it through?
We'll see how long it takes, and we can do that if we have to, yes.
Thank
you. Have him come back again another time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Wes Koistra. I'm the Deputy Regional Administrator for the Metropolitan Council. I'm going to go at a much faster pace than I intended to, so forgive me if it seems that I'm running through this information, but I want to get through this as much as we possibly can. The Metropolitan Council was created in 1967 to plan for the orderly and economical growth of the seven-county metro area. Its purpose was to coordinate delivery of services that couldn't be provided efficiently by any single community. In the 1960s, we were in an environment where there was many changes occurring in the metro area. The freeway system was developing. There was rapid growth in the suburbs. There were some particular opportunities, but there were some particular challenges with that. There were failing backyard septic systems. Inadequately treated wastewater was being discharged into our waterways. The private bus service of the time was starting to decline. Fares were increasing. Fleets were aging. And there were reductions in ridership. There was rapid growth occurring in green spaces that were felt to be better suited for preservation. And we were experiencing growing fiscal disparities across communities, that some of which did not have an adequate tax base or tax structure to fund essential services. So the Twin Cities was experiencing the growing pains and the opportunities of a large metro region. There was a desire for greater cooperation across the region in 1967 through the encouragement of local governments, businesses, and civic leaders. They created the Metropolitan Council at that time primarily as a planning agency for the region. Also at that time, transit and wastewater services were actually operated by separate boards, and it was not till 1994 that those services were brought to the council. The Metropolitan Council is made up of 17 members. The state statute has structured this so that these members are appointed by the governor and serve at the will of the governor. There are 16 members that represent geographic districts across the region that are divided by population size. The chair serves at large. Our current chair is Chair Susan Haig. This chart shows the districts across the region. Generally, districts have been typically drawn with consideration not just to population, which is a requirement of statute, but also to local government boundaries, cities, county boundaries, to the extent possible, and meet within the other criteria of drawing up districts. I would mention that we are due for redistricting. Redistricting occurs in each year that ends with a 3 because of as a response to the census, and so there should be redistricting activity in the legislature this year. Also, I'll mention that many of the governor's appointees, the appointments have to be confirmed by the Senate. Last year's legislature, the 2012 legislature, confirmed 6 of the 17 appointments. 10 district representative council members and the chair are scheduled for confirmation hearing, I believe, on the 28th of January. This is a structural or functional organizational chart. It provides our major activities and legislative authority that's behind those activities. I'm not going to walk through that. I'll just again say that primarily our responsibilities are for region-wide planning, for providing the direct services, and for grant making. In terms of planning, we do water quality, supply and management planning, land use planning, parks planning, transportation planning. We are required to do a regional forecast that we update every 10 years, again after the census. And that forecast and all these other planning activities are brought together in a comprehensive development plan and guide for the region that's done every 10 years. And this year, this particular plan is being referred to as Thrive MSP 2040. The council also, as I mentioned, provides direct services. We provide wastewater. We manage the wastewater system throughout the region. That's through 7 different plants. We provide most of the transportation services in the region. Some are provided by suburban transit providers, otherwise known as opt-out providers, but we provide probably about 94% of the transit ridership. And we provide affordable housing services. We have the largest HRA in the Twin Cities area. But we're also a funder and a grant maker. We provide livable communities grants to local communities for economic development and brownfield cleanup. We provide inflow and infiltration grants, a small amount of grants that have been authorized through this body to local communities to reduce the unnecessary inflow of groundwater into the wastewater system. And we provide the allocation and pass-through of federal and state dedicated transportation funds to the various providers, not only Metro Transit, the provider that is under our umbrella, but also to the suburban transit providers. These are just some highlights out of our regional forecast. That we're expecting over the next, it's a 30-year forecast, we're expecting over the next 30 years to see a population growth of about 900,000 people in the seven-county metro region. We're looking at a employment growth of almost 600,000 jobs. 62% of the new households will not have children. 43% of the regional residents will be non-white. It's not surprising that we're expecting to see over 100% growth in seniors. This might be a subject, the regional forecast is really important to this region. It's important to the state. It's what we do our planning and land use planning around. If this body certainly was interested in hearing more, we'd be more than willing to bring our forecasters to your committee, if you would ever have time for that, and talk to you a little bit more about what we're seeing and the specifics of the regional forecast for the metropolitan region. This is a 10,000-foot view of our budget, of our operating budget of $821 million for the we have a calendar year operating budget. This is calendar year 2013 that we've just entered. I will say when you look at the, it includes direct operations that we fund within our organization. It also includes those grant-making activities, the pass-throughs of grants and loans, and then debt service for our capital program. It would not probably surprise you that that in the blue section, our primary amount of funds is goes towards our transportation transit services. It is a staff heavy, operations heavy business. That's $425 million, or almost three quarters of that blue section. Environmental services really has more of their costs divided between debt service and operations, and they represent about 22% of that blue section. Community development much smaller at about 3%, and regional administration. It comes in at about 1% of that blue part of the pie. In terms of pass-through grants and loans, more than half of those grants and loans are housing assistance payments made through our Metro HRA, $57 million worth. $56 million of that money, it comes from the federal government. The remaining money comes from MHFA. $25 million of the pass-through grants and loans, or about almost 25% of that, represents pass-through of Minnesota vehicle sales tax funds that are dedicated to transit operations, and we pass through that money to suburban transit providers. There is $19 million that goes towards those economic development grants that I mentioned earlier. And then there's $8.5 million that is regional parks operations maintenance grants, some of that money coming from our state appropriations. Debt service represents $146 million, or about 18% of our total operating budget. In the area of debt service, it's dominated by environmental services. You would imagine that a wastewater system is capital heavy. Our capital program and our wastewater system represents probably about 45% of its total budget. About $100 million of the $146 million. The remaining is about $40 million of transit debt service and about a little over $4 million of parks debt service. We do have the authority to levy taxes. Our levies represent a little less than 10% of our total budget. Our total levies, which I'll show you a little more about in the next slide, are about $77 million. About 45% of these levies are imposed throughout the seven-county area. About 55% of the levy is for transit debt service, and that's only imposed in the transit taxing district, which is a subset of the total seven-county area. Our levy is relatively small compared to other local levies in the Twin Cities metro area. It's only about 1.7% of the $4.5 billion of levies in the region. Our levy growth, as this is showing in this chart, our levies are represented by the bottom line. You will see inflation is represented by the line that shows the orange diamond data points, and then you'll see in the dark blue is the county growth in levies. The green is cities and towns, and that top line represents schools. Our levies over this 10-year period have grown by about an average of 1% per year. Some of that growth is attributed by cities who've asked to join the transit taxing district because they want regular route services to those cities. And so if you didn't include the growth in the transit size of the transit taxing district, our levies would have grown less than 1% per year over this period of time. But again, these levies represent only about less than 10% of our total budget. This is a pie chart showing how our levies are distributed. Again, it's dominated by transit debt service, which is about 55% of our levies. Parks debt service is 7%, so debt service does represent over 60% of our levies. And then we have a general purposes levy that is used for general administration and purposes. And we have what's called RALF, or Right-of-Way Acquisition Loan Fund, that we use to purchase in advance right-of-ways where there's plans to be needs for transportation-related right-of-ways. Our tax-based revitalization account, TIBRA, is a $5 million amount that's fixed. It's done through that's provided through the disproportionate share funds. And then we have the local, the livable communities demonstration account at about $11 million that we fund those economic development grants and housing grants that Guy will talk about more when we get to his section. This next slide is a slide showing our total FTEs at the council comparing 2003 with 2012. Today we have about a little over 3,700 full-time employees. 10 years ago we had a little over 3,800 full-time employees, so we have reduced in size in terms of total employees. There's reasons for that. We've taken advantage of technology in our wastewater system where we don't need as many employees to operate that. We've taken advantage of technology in our transportation system where we're able to have very sophisticated algorithms that show where the best routes should be located to get the greatest service, best service to the greatest service to the greatest need. It also help these systems help us to schedule our operators and just help us to become more efficient. In addition, we've consolidated a lot of our overhead operations, such as human resources, information technology services, contracts, procurement, risk management, and legal. We've consolidated these into centralized offices so that we don't have separate HR offices and IS offices in each of those areas. You would notice on here that the bottom, the dark blue area is transit. You'll see that the dark blue, on top of the dark blue area in 2012, you'll see a green bar. That's rail service, because we've really been developing the light rail since 2003, and we have really been able to develop the rail service without growth in employees, essentially absorbing the operations and FTE requirements of rail services into what we'd previously had in our bus operations. This is just to give you a little heads up on what we'll be bringing to the legislature. I mentioned that council redistricting is scheduled. That's something that is initiated by this body. We're going to be requesting to extend the authorization of the Water Supply Advisory Committee their authorization ended at the end of last year, 2012. We've been relying on this group as we've been asked by this body to do planning activities addressing water supply needs across the region. As you can imagine, water supply is a regional issue. Water used in one area affects water available in another area. They use a similar aquifer, they use similar waterways, and we've seen pretty extreme examples of where lack of planning may cause issues for communities. That's the overview. Mr. Chair, I was going to head into a very brief overview of transportation. I'm not sure where you're at with your time.
We're getting close to the end of our time here. We may have you come back and do the transportation, although we don't have purview over that. That goes to the Transportation Committee. Back to your chart about the changes in property tax levies. You were saying that they've gone up 1% a year. We were looking at the 36.8, and Representative Quam sent me a note here. And maybe he can ask the I'll let him ask the question about that. It just seems like they're only going 1% a year. 36.8% increase seems like it doesn't jive with
your inflation, Mr. Chair. The inflation on there, you're going up about 6% per year for the first five, and over the 8 years, you're at 3.5%, and that just seemed a little bit high. So if you've got offline send and then details, mine's black and white, so you know, the details on the different counties, so we can understand the
Mr. Chair, I can very quickly Mr. Chair, Representative Plum, our change in our levies is the bottom line, the red line. So we've gone since 2003, our levies have improved a total of 13%. A small portion of that, about 3% of that, is because communities have added themselves to the tax to the transit taxing district. So they've asked us to add service to them, and they've asked to become part of our transit taxing district levies. If you take those communities out, our total levy has increased 10.9%. The next line up, the shown at 36.8%, that's the implicit price deflator for government that is used to determine what levy caps are used. It's really a measure of government inflation. So simply, we're trying to show here that our levy increases, and I qualify this by saying levies are only 10% of our budget, but our levy increases have been significantly below the rate of government inflation, and have been averaging about 1% a year. I hope that's
helpful. That answers the question.
If you have a black and white in front of you, it's going to be really confusing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Kuster. Any other questions? If not, thank you for your presentation, and hopefully we can have you come back at another time and go further into the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Ward, have you read the minutes?
Sorry, no.
Representative Quam, you read the minutes.
I have reviewed the minutes, and I would move that we would adopt them.
Representative Quam moves that the minutes be adopted from the meeting of January 22nd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. And with that, I believe we're adjourned.